Your Royal Highness, HRH Aji Sonam Dechen Wangchuk, Lempos, distinguished participants in the conference from the United States, distinguished participants in the conference from the villages from Tashigang to Baro, teachers, students, it's a happy occasion to see students for the first time in the conference, and guests. I would first like to seek Your Highness's permission to speak for about 6 minutes. May I first outline the order of this morning's inaugural program. After my welcome address, we would be honored if Your Royal Highness could address the conference. Then, on behalf of the distinguished participants from the United States, Stephen Evans, the co-sponsor of the conference and communication specialist, the International Center for Ethnographic Studies, will make a statement and submit a token of their respect to Your Royal Highness. After that, in a slight departure from the normal pattern of inaugural ceremonies, I would like to request Dr. Joseph Sobol, Professor of Storytelling, East Tennessee State University, to make an offering of mandolin instrumental to Your Royal Highness and the guest. Finally, Soki Zango will move a vote of thanks. Nothing could memorialize or perpetuate in our memory this occasion better than a group photograph as a souvenir of this auspicious inaugural. We would like to request Your Royal Highness to grant us a group photograph to be taken outside after the inauguration and before the tea refreshment, which is also going to be served outside. So on behalf of all of us, the participants and the guests from both within and outside Bhutan, I wish to submit our gratitude to Your Royal Highness for your gracious presence amongst us this morning. I also wish to thank all of you, the guests, for honoring this conference and expressing your appreciation by coming to this inauguration graced by Her Royal Highness Aji Sonam Dechen Wangchuk. Please allow me to submit by way of background that some years ago, Stephen Evans became interested in the form and substance of Bhutanese folk tales, which were altogether engaging, not only of themselves, but also as a tenant of Bhutanese culture. He then proposed a storytelling conference to be supported financially also through his mobilization efforts. And here I would like to thank the institute which he is serving, and the president of the institute is also here amongst us today. So through their financial contribution, what we see today is the beginning of this conference, which we are very fortunate to be blessed and inaugurated by Your Royal Highness. I do hope that the future work in this neglected field will receive Your Royal Highness's gracious patronage as we begin this very important journey today, not on a personal but on an institutional basis. On a personal basis, there has been effort. Several individuals have privately made the effort to write down folk tales, feeling the urgent responsibility to do so. Before the progress of technologies of communication, in a very paradoxical and ironical fashion, kills that voice of past, the stories. But converting the oral stories into writing is really half a imperfect measure only, as you all know. But in this conference, we will not only write, but capture the cadence of storytelling, the musical quality of language, and the manner of the speaker himself or herself. We wish to capture the creative art of storytelling in electronic form that can then become part of the mass media, as told by master storytellers and elders, some of who are with us today, as I mentioned earlier, from Tashigang, Pumthang, Paro, Mongar, Shah, and so forth. We also wish to bring a compendium of folk tales, both shared today and that we have received from others, and make that very accessible and engaging so that this system of preservation will allow future scholarship to take place. Your Royal Highness, may I submit that as I look back to my own childhood, raised partly at the feet of a monastic priest who told me stories, the tradition of storytelling seemed at that time to be so monumental and so prominent a tradition. But how can traditions be so fragile, we now know. I cannot and have not retold these stories since then, and thus I have broken a strand in our tradition before we could keep archives and films. So the whole effort is really a race against time. The safe deposit of stories, as you all know, is not at all secure and permanent. And I hope that this seminal effort, begun under Your Royal Highness's aegis, lights up all of our drive to preserve the voice of the past. Once again, in conclusion, all of us here wish to thank Your Royal Highness for being with us and giving a very special meaning to this event. Thank you, Your Royal Highness.
To be among you this morning for the opening of the National Storytelling Conference makes me very happy. This wonderful initiative is truly commendable, and I would like to thank everyone involved in working towards recognizing, reviving, and promoting our rich oral traditions. As a child, growing up, my brothers, sisters, and I would sit in a circle as our grandmother would tell us exciting stories about adventure, travel, bravery, tact, and justice, undoubtedly intended to mold our moral values. We would sit quietly in awe as we listen to those stories, and I look forward to passing those stories to my children and grandchildren someday. Storytelling is a special bond between elders and children, and the means of one generation passing on our tradition and culture and moral values to the next. Community storytelling reinforces these social bonds that connect individuals to their community through a shared experience of traditional knowledge and heritage. In this way, each member of the community possesses a piece of common knowledge that would enable a better understanding of the time and the society that they live in. For instance, satire and nuances of certain communities can be captured in stories that reflect the times. Another aspect of storytelling is its purpose of history. The author becomes the storyteller, and the facts become their truth. As stories are passed on from one generation to the other, they become unique to the storyteller, but at the same time, they share a common thread of the past. It is continuity at its most alive and its best. In today's society, it is a pity that one of the oldest and most powerful expressions of individual and cultural creativity, traditional storytelling, has been taken over by other means of mass media, such as television and the internet. Today, young children rarely sit around their grandparents and elders and listen to stories. In fact, In most urban areas, social relationships are often weakened by these new forms of media. With the rise of these new technological storytelling mediums, the cultural prominence of traditional storytelling as an art form is transforming. The need to make storytelling a widespread practice in our culture has many positive benefits. Oral history and culture found in songs, music, dance, loze, and folk tales are an integral part of a unique Bhutanese culture and identity. Storytelling is an important part of this history and culture. Its dynamic warmth and spontaneity are unique to itself. It is a valuable source of shared memory and for the younger generation, a better understanding of the past. All of us must make an effort to retell those stories we heard in our childhood as a first step towards helping revive our precious oral traditions. Thank you, and Tashdeer.
The first one is called The Princess Royal, and the second one is called The Star of Munster. So, for you, Your Highness.
To be at this conference, as well as give the opening presentation. Also, I get very nervous when doing public speaking, so please bear with me. I hope that several of you have received these two art prints that have been passed around. One is a painting of Memehelehele. On the back is the story of Memehelehele. The painting was actually commissioned and presented here in Bhutan last year to one of your distinguished citizens. The second one is the Four Harmonious Friends. And on the back is the story of the Four Harmonious Friends. I'll be referring to both of those stories in my talk this morning. In Central Asia, there's the story of a man who found a magic cup. And he learned that if he wept into the cup, his tears would turn into valuable gemstones. And even though this man was a poor man, he was a happy man. And he didn't have really much reason to cry. And so he found ways to make himself weep, to make himself sad, so that his tears could make him rich. As the riches piled up, so did the greed inside pile up. The story ends with the man sitting on a mountain of precious gems, a knife in one hand. He's weeping helplessly, his wife dead beside him. This picture is a picture, a sad picture, of a distorted happiness. Very different from the picture we have in Bhutan of happiness found in the story of Meme Hele Hele. We all know this story. It's a great story. One day there lived a man named Meme Hele Hele. One day he decided to go to the fields, to work the fields. He wanted to prepare them for planting. And as he was working on the fields, tilling up the dirt, he found a clump of weeds, we call them weeds. And he worked to pull up the weeds and they wouldn't come, and he pulled and they wouldn't come, and he pulled and they wouldn't come. And finally, they came out of the ground. And underneath was a turquoise, a beautiful turquoise, a big turquoise, a valuable turquoise, more valuable than any he had ever seen before. Well, Meme Hele Hele thought, I'm now a rich man. I don't have to work anymore. So this turquoise, so heavy he could barely carry it, he took it and he went on his way home, a happy man, a rich man. On the way, he met a man leading a horse. Hey, Meme Hele Hele, how's it going? Oh, I went to my fields today to prepare them for planting, and I found this valuable turquoise, and now I'm a rich man. I don't have to work anymore. And then Meme Hele Hele said, by the way, you wouldn't be interested in trading that horse for this turquoise, would you? Oh, Meme Hele Hele, don't tease me. Don't tease me. That valuable turquoise is nothing compared to my old horse. Valuable turquoise, old horse, just decide, do you want to make the trade or not? Meme Hele Hele said, well, I sure do, the man said. So they traded. And the man walked away with this valuable turquoise, a very happy man. Meme Hele Hele walked down the road with a horse, even a happier man. He's walking down the road, sees a man with an ox or a cow. The man with the cow said, hey, Meme Hele Hele, how's it going? Oh, I'm a very happy man, Meme Hele Hele said. I went to my fields today to prepare them for planting, and I found a valuable turquoise. And I traded this valuable turquoise for this horse. By the way, you wouldn't be interested in trading that ox for this horse, would you? Well, I sure would, said the man with the ox. And so they traded, and a man walked down the road with a horse, a very happy man. Meme Hele Hele walked down the road with the ox, even a happier man. Well, he traded the ox for a sheep. He traded the sheep for a goat. And finally, as he was walking down the road, he traded the goat for a rooster. On his way home, carrying the rooster, he hears a song. Oh, it's a beautiful song. In fact, it's the most beautiful song he'd ever heard, and was so beautiful it brought tears to his eyes, made his heart so happy. And he's thinking, this song, just hearing it makes me so happy. If I could sing it, how happy would I be? He sees the man. He said, would you teach me that song? I'll give you this rooster if you teach me that song. And so the man says, sure. He teaches Memehelehele the song. Memehelehele gives him the rooster. And Memehelehele walks down the road singing the song, the happiest, most successful businessman in the whole world. I can hear Memehelehele now, walking down the road, singing, in my heart there's a song that I sing all day long. I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy. You know, that story is not the national folktale. But maybe it should be, I don't know. But research shows that indeed, Bhutan is a happy nation. A happy nation, a healthy nation when it comes to its values, when it comes to personal values, when it comes to national values. To date, 9 countries in the world have conducted national values assessments. Bhutan is one of those 9 countries. The national values assessments are prepared by various organizations, various agencies, in cooperation with a research center called the Barrett Value Center. Bhutan's study was done in cooperation with the Center for Bhutan Studies, East Tennessee State University, the Brimstone Award for Applied Storytelling, of course, my organization, the International Center for Ethnographic Studies. The results were released in January 2009. And they can be seen in the current issue, I believe, in the current issue of the Journal for Bhutan Studies, if you're interested in that report. But the survey confirms that Bhutan is indeed a healthy nation, a happy nation, as far as morals and values are concerned. In fact, indications are for Bhutan that Bhutan may be, in terms of national and personal values, Bhutan may be the healthiest in the world. One of the elements measured in the National Values Assessment is that called entropy. Now, when I first heard that word, I had to go look it up because I didn't know what it meant. Entropy. Entropy are those distinguishing factors in a culture that may lead to dysfunction in a system, dysfunction in a culture. Bhutan's entropy, in as far as its value system is concerned, is 4%. 4%. The other 8 countries are like this. Denmark is 21%. Sweden is 31%. Canada is 32%. The United Kingdom is 43%. The United States is 53%. Latvia, 54%. Iceland, 54%. And Argentina, 60%. So Bhutan's 4% entropy reflects that Bhutan truly is, by means of scientific research and studying the values and value systems of individually and nationally, Bhutan is a healthy and a happy nation. The assessment measures values in 3 areas. The personal values of the citizens of Bhutan, how the citizens of Bhutan see the value system of their country, and what the citizens of Bhutan would like for the values to be of their country. And the survey showed that the people of Bhutan demonstrate support for one another, encouragement for one another. They have a focus on enriching knowledge and understanding. The people of Bhutan have a positive outlook on life. They have an inner drive and strength, and the wonderful thing for me is that the number one value found in the survey for Bhutan, the number one value of the people of Bhutan, was friendship. Above all else, they value friendship. The other high-level values are education, compassion, sincerity, social justice, self-discipline, optimism, being helpful, and caring for one another. What wonderful values for a nation to have. Unlike any other nation in the world so far, what wonderful values for the people of Bhutan to have these as their highest values. The current values that the nation has, according to its citizens, are environmental protection, the importance of religion, political rights, education, nature conservation, shared vision, the availability of information, shared values, contentment, and social justice. Now, these aren't what they want. These are what the people of Bhutan say they're getting from their nation. Again, a very healthy picture of how the people of Bhutan perceive the government, the nation, the monarchy, reaching out to the people and providing these basic, more than basic needs, these social, moral, religious needs for the people. Well, as I mentioned, I think it's interesting to note that the number one personal value of the Bhutanese is friendship. And of course, that reminds me of a Bhutanese story. And I'm sure you've heard it, you know it, the Four Harmonious Friends. That, I think, is probably the national folktale. A wonderful story. In the forest, four animals, an elephant, a rabbit, a monkey, and a partridge. And they were discussing the ownership of a tree in the forest. And the elephant said, "That's my tree. I come and eat the fruits off of that tree every day." Well, monkey said, "No, you don't see any fruits on that tree right now, do you?" And the elephant said, "No." The monkey says, "Because I got them before you got here. It's my tree." Well, rabbit said, "No. Before the tree ever had fruits, I ate the leaves off of the tree, so it's my tree." Partridge said, "No. That tree wouldn't be here if I hadn't dropped the seed, and it grew into a tree." So the three others all agreed that the tree was Partridge's tree, and they acknowledged Partridge as the elder brother to all of them. Well, these four animals became friends, and they agreed to share the tree together. And so they gathered the fruits from the tree. Rabbit and Partridge got which fell onto the ground and got from the lower branches. Monkey would get up and get some of the higher fruits. Elephant would reach even higher to get the fruits. When they needed to, monkey would get on the back of elephant. Rabbit would get on the back of monkey. Partridge would get on the back of rabbit to reach the highest. And so people saw these, the other animals saw these as four harmonious friends working together in harmony and in friendship to accomplish common purposes and common goals. And they were looked upon as an example of peace and harmony, cooperation, interdependence, and friendship. Now, while we can rejoice that this study of Bhutan, the National Values Assessment, we can rejoice that it shows Bhutan in such a wonderful light, that it shows Bhutan as being healthy as far as the value systems are concerned, the healthiest in the world, far, far healthier than even the next country. And we can rejoice that stories such as the Four Harmonious Friends and stories such as Meme Hele Hele truly do indeed reflect the value system of the nation. There is a word of caution here. That word of caution comes from His Majesty, the fifth King of Bhutan. In his coronation address, not too long ago in November, he shared some words for the citizens of this country. And if you would allow me, I would like to repeat the words of His Majesty, the fifth King. For in his coronation address, He recognized that core values are the common thread that holds the people and the nation together. And in his address, he expressed his deep concern that as the world changes, Bhutan may lose its fundamental values, which rest the character of the nation and the people. In the address, he said, "Our generation of Bhutanese have been gifted a strong, dynamic nation by our forefathers." He said, "I am confident that as long as we are willing to work with their commitment and dedication, follow their example, we can bring greater peace, happiness, and prosperity to our country. I am confident because I know the worth and the character of our people." He said to the people of Bhutan, "You are the true jewel of this nation. As citizens of a spiritual land, you treasure the qualities of good human being: honesty, kindness, integrity, unity, respect for culture and traditions, love for country and for God." And then he said, "Throughout our history, our parents have upheld these values and placed the common good above self." But then he said, "My deepest concern is that as the world changes, we may lose these fundamental values on which rest our character as a nation and a people. It is critical that we as Bhutanese recognize the character of our people, irrespective of how far we look back and how far into the future we look. The Bhutan we see is vastly different, unrecognizable when compared to the Bhutan of the first king. Yet the character of our people, the nature of our fundamental values, have remained unchanged. Henceforth, even more dramatic changes transform the world and our nation, as long as we continue to pursue the simple and timeless goal of being good human beings, as long as we strive to build a nation that stands for everything that is good, we can ensure that our future generations for hundreds of years will live in happiness and peace." Those are the words of His Majesty the 15th Bhutan. A beautiful vision of how His Majesty recognized the values of the people of Bhutan and how he saw that they were a treasure to be treasured by the nation and by the people. And yet at the same time, he expresses a deep concern that Bhutan may lose this value system as the world around Bhutan begins to change. Dashu Kinley Dorji, who's here with us, went to speak to a presentation that he gave in Bangkok that I heard a couple of years ago. I admire Dashu very much, and I admire what he's doing for this country. I admire the writings that he has published, nonfiction tales of Bhutan, wonderful tales. One of them he shared and he spoke about in Bangkok is a story called Pretty Woman. A wonderful story, one that touched me deeply, and his explanation behind the story was also very touching. His creative nonfiction, Pretty Woman, portrays how the introduction of television into Bhutan in 1999 thrust the country into dramatic and even painful change. The story tells over a period of 7 years of a young woman and a young boy, and how they collide with a world around them, a world of change, a world that's difficult to understand. They collide with forces that are much greater than themselves, with forces that are much greater than their nation, and with forces that are much greater than their community. The woman, the young woman in the story, was the prettiest girl in the village. Oh, she was beautiful. A face like a moon, a voice like a beautiful bird. Darkened skin, hardworking, strong. She enchanted all the men of the village. The boy is a young boy, growing up in a volatile climate of change, confused by what he observes. Now, Dashu says that this story really asks us, and I'll tell a little bit about the story in a minute, but the story asks us some very fundamental questions. He said, is this country being changed more by the side effects of development than the development processes themselves? And he begins to share with us what some of those side effects are. Television, he says, far exceeds the advantages of electricity in the villages. The electricity in the story comes in the year 2003. In a country where there are now 50,000 television sets, Dashu says, there are only 14,000 computers. And the television now has a place of honor in the altar rooms. In the altar rooms of the homes, as it does in the story. Now, over a period of 7 years in the story, the country's heroes no longer are the royal family. The country's hero is no longer the king, but the heroes are the Bollywood stars. And the heroes are the athletes. And the beautiful girl is no longer the village beauty with the face round as a moon and voice as beautiful as a bird. But the beautiful girl are the Bollywood dancers. And the beautiful girl is the, I've seen it here too, that the girl in the Pepsi billboard in a bathing suit and holding a bottle of Pepsi. They become the heroes. They become the heroes. And the end of the story, Pretty Woman, is both poignant and bittersweet. The end of the story shows the young woman, maybe not so young, looking out into the village. And she says to the young boy who's sitting there or standing there, they are so pretty, she says, the girls. They're so thin. They're so fair. They smell so nice. And she looks at Coonley, the boy, a gangly 5'9", standing with his hands in his pockets. And she turns and looks out the window once again. And she says, you better study hard, Coonley. Otherwise, you'll have to live in the village. You'll have to work all day in the sun. You'll have to walk everywhere with no shoes. You'll have to carry manure on your back and smell of cow dung. In the village, you'll quickly become ugly, she said. We have no choice because we're already old and ugly. Coonley says nothing. He doesn't know what to say. Trumi is only 27 years old. In the eyes of Coonley, she's not changed. She's still beautiful, but the world around them has changed. Now, Dasho says this story is the story of Bhutan. It's the story of Bhutan. And I think he may be right, but the change of a rural society is documented through the eyes of these two. And it shows change happening from a current generation to the next generation. And he says there are no subtleties in this story because the story is not subtle. The message that comes through the two pairs of eyes is the impact of globalization, and there's an urgent need to put on the brakes, he says, before it's too late. One of the things I like, what Dasho challenged us in Bangkok, was that there's the need for stories to address this issue of a loss of identity, a loss of character as a community, as an individual, as a nation. And the stories need to put this as a platform before the people. These stories need to be written like this story of Pretty Woman. They need to be written. They need to be told. They need to be passed on. And what a wonderful collection of stories he has put together, including the story Pretty Woman. Others agree with Dasho's assessment of the importance of values preservation and values transmission. I read an article by Tashi Wangyal, is that right? Yeah. Enduring Social Sustainability. But Tashi says there's a need to provide a sense of continuity amidst change. And that's so true. In addition, since culture and tradition values form the bedrock of Bhutanese national identity, it's important for Bhutanese to ensure that its cultures and values are not undermined. It is now more necessary than ever to ensure the intergenerational transmission of values. Otherwise, modernization may destroy the very spiritual and cultural fabric that has enabled the Bhutanese society to live in harmony. So, what can be done? What What can we do about this? One author of a book called Storytelling, Faith, Imagination, and Faith says, every nation, every people, every community has stories and myths that preserve the tradition that gives them their identity. When a nation is in trouble, it turns to its stories to seek identity. When the nation is in trouble, it returns to the traditional stories to look for direction, to look for healing, to regain a sense of what made it great in the past and what will nurture it into the future. I like what he said here. A person without a story is a person with amnesia. A country without a story has ceased to exist. A humanity without a story has lost its soul. Another author who has written a book called If This Is Your Land, Where Are Your Stories? Tells about a group of indigenous people of Canada. The indigenous people of Canada had a section of land in that large country. The government wanted to take the land away from them, turn it into government land. They met with the indigenous leaders to discuss this acquisition of traditional land turning over to the government. They came to a deadlock. The people did not want the government to take their land. The government decided they would take it. One of the elders of the indigenous people spoke up, and he said to the leader of the government delegation, if this is your land, where are your stories? If this is your land, where are your stories? The government didn't have a story to tell. They didn't have the stories of the tradition and the culture and the heritage of the people in the land. And in this story, the indigenous people won. The government didn't take away their land because they didn't have the stories to prove that it was their land. If this is your land, where are your stories? The question carries with it the importance of a people's story and its contribution to their sense of identity and their contribution to a sense of community. It's interesting how identity here, this story, is tied to land. The possession of land. It's tied to culture. It's tied to history. And what's interesting for me is that the story glues it all together. The story of the people, it's the glue that holds culture, holds history, that holds land, that holds identity together. The original inhabitants of this tale seem to be saying, our land, our language, our stories, our history, our heritage, our identity, the very core being of who we are all tied together, all integrated. And to threaten any one of these is to threaten all of them. And this, for me, seems to be true for the nation of Bhutan as well. Khunzang Chogan, all of you know her, the beloved folktale author and teller of the much-loved folktales of Bhutan. She pushes for the promotion of storytelling in her country. This oral tradition, she said, transmitted by one generation to another, is thus the continuing and living thread that links one generation to the other. As I realized the importance of the stories as a link to who I am and where I come from, she said, I also realized how important they will be to my children. It's interesting sitting with Her Majesty during the coffee break, how she said that she looked forward to passing the stories that she learned on to future generations of her family. But Khunzang Chogan said, the stories will be of some value to the lives of children to link up with their cultural base, so in knowing their base, they may better understand and appreciate their own lives. Another person whom I admire very much, he's also present in the room, has done a lot of studies in Bhutanese folklore, Dorji Pinjori, senior researcher at the Center for Bhutan Studies, has written a lot in the area of folklore in Bhutan. And as with Dashu, I consider him a mentor, though he may not know it, but a mentor for me in Bhutanese folklore. He has also written and said some wonderful things about the expression of folktales and the relation to morals and values. Stories express moral or practical wisdom, he said, and provide an insight into the adult world for children. It's common for village elders to quote from some well-known folktale to pass on the values to a child. Listening to folktales momentarily transports the audience to a different world. Later reflection connects the folktale world to the real world, a world that they would soon face as adults, children would soon face as adults. I'm reminded of another story. This is a story called Strength. It's a favorite story of mine. It's a story that turns from delight to disaster. It's endearing, it's sobering, it's thought-provoking. The story of Strength. One day, Elephant has the idea to have a competition to see who is the strongest. So Monkey ties a tree into a knot. That's strength, they said. That's strength. Well, Deer runs 5 kilometers and then 5 kilometers back. That's strength, they said. That's strength. Tiger mightily claws the ground. That's strength, they said. Yeah, that's strength. Antelope plows the fields with its horns. Strength, they all cheered. That's strength. Elephant went to a tree, put its head against a tree, knocked the tree down. Strength, strength, they said. That's strength. Well, then it was man's turn. Man comes, and he twirls around, and he dances, and he does somersaults, and they said, that's not strength. He climbs a tree, and he picks the fruits, and he throws the fruits down, and they said, that's not strength. He takes a gun, and he kills elephant. And he yells, strength, strength, that's strength. Wasn't that strength? Strength. He looks around. There are no animals there. He's by himself. Strength, he yells. Man was alone. In the forest, the other animals gathered. They said to one another, did you see that? What was that? Was that strength? No, and I said, that wasn't strength. That was death. Yes, that was death, they said. Well, since that day, animal won't walk with man in the forest. When man enters the forest, he must walk alone. The animals still talk of man, that creature, man. He's the one who can't tell the difference between strength and death. What a wonderful story, I think. A story that reflects the truth, I think, that stories have the ability to penetrate the heart. Stories have the ability to speak a language that we as humans can understand. They don't speak in propositional terms. They don't speak in factual knowledge. They don't speak of principles. And in reality, the heart doesn't respond to propositional knowledge and facts and figures and principles. The heart responds to beauty and art and nature and mystery and joy and love and happiness. The heart responds to story. The language of the heart is story. The language of the heart is story. Our souls speak not in the facts of mathematics. Our souls don't speak in the propositions of systematic theology. Our souls don't speak in propositional analysis. Our souls speak through the images and the emotions of stories. Our souls respond to the images and emotions of stories. Our heart responds to the images and emotions of story. Without intellectual assent, without permission, when we hear a story, we don't say we give that story permission to impact our lives. We hear it. And that story, like a seed, becomes planted in our heart. And like a seed, it begins to germinate and to sprout and to take root and to grow. And one day we realize, what is that story doing there? We don't even realize the impact that a story has. We say, what is that story doing there? And we realize that because that story has implanted in our lives, we see life differently. We see people we've never noticed before. We see things that we've never paid attention to before. And those stories have made a difference. The deepest connections of our heart are formed by stories. Well, there's a wonderful traditional Tibetan proverb that says, what is written in ink can fade away by a single drop of water, but what is written on the heart will last an eternity. It seems that every individual that I know asks the basic questions, who am I?
Who am I?
Where do I belong? What are the accepted norms of behavior for me? And I believe that a people's stories help answer those questions of who am I? Where do I belong? What am I supposed to be? But the stories of the people also help shape those answers. The questions touch the very core of being. Identity, community, society, culture, nationhood. Now, colleagues of mine, anthropologists and sociologists and ethnographers, and cultural researchers, all that whole world of academia, agree that to investigate the idea of self, to investigate the idea of identity, whether personal or cultural or national, we've got to investigate the stories. And to touch self, to touch community, to touch nationhood, to touch who we are, we do it through stories. Stories are an integral part of life. They shape our language, they shape our religion, they shape our ethnicities, they shape who we are.
Thank you very much. I think after listening to this beautiful song, all our heart must have been full. So there's going to be very few words. Actually, my presentation, the elements of dissent in some Bhutanese folktales and the writing of the local narratives follows from my first speaker, Mr. Steve Evans. This is basically about what happens when those morals are not observed or practiced, especially by a special group of people. And this was actually I have written in Australia when I was studying, and then once I'm here, I never had a chance to complete it because, as you must have known, the folk tale, writing of folk tales or compilation of folk tales, folklore, whatever it might be, is considered not so important unless some individuals come up and then take it as their private initiative or their private interest. And this is this applies to me. I've never found time to write about folk tales officially, but these are something which I take it as a personal interest whenever I have free time. Yeah, my presentation has been arranged in the following manner. I'll first talk about the premise, some assumptions about this paper, then the classification of the social groups into two big people and small people, then what are the elements of dissent we find across some Bhutanese folktales, the context in which these folktales had been composed, and why did it compose, and what are the functions it served. And then I want to discuss one Bhutanese folktale as a case study, the Lazy Boy and the King, and then relate the study of Bhutanese folktales containing the element of dissent into a subaltern literature which is a discipline in South Asian universities, and then how such studies contribute to the construction of local narratives. Now, these are some of the premises in which this paper has been written, and I'm sure some of us here will think that I make some overclaims here, and this is the same point I have, I have thought, and this is the challenge I'm going to take over the last few years, and I think. In about 2 or 3 years' time, you'll have some clear empirical proof of what I try to make here. The first premise is that I think when you listen to my presentation here, you have to keep these things in mind, that folk tales reflect social, economic, and political time, milieu of a particular time and place. So this has to be kept in, because without this, I think it will be very difficult to follow what some of the points here. And the second one is the folk tales originated from the common people. And there's one theory by German folklorist Hans Naumann, who says that the folklore originated from the intelligentsia, the high people, and then it slowly trickled down to the peasantry or the farmers. And this is the, my paper basically argues against this theory. And in some of the folk tales, there are some elements of dissent, you know, the characters coming from the small people, like farmers, reveling or, you know, not really agreeing with the higher people, characters coming from high people, such as the lamas, the rulers, you know, the big, the merchant or rich neighbors. And then you also see that people asking for kidu, farmers facing hardship, and then they actually not agreeing with the system. And folk tale here, the definition I have used is all Buddhist tales which actually begins with Gangpo and Dingpo, which is equivalent to long, long ago or once upon a time. So these are some of the tales I have chosen to for my analysis. I think it's very important to understand two classification of people, the big people and the small people. In the conventional general understanding, it means the elite are the big people and the common people are the small people. So big people, in our discourse, you always say mi bom and mi chung ko, you know, big people and small people. So the big people are mi bom with that coercive state power, you know, who have political, social, religious, cultural powers. They enjoy these powers, and then they actually impose these powers on the small people. So they are the ruling elites, the nobilities in Buddhist context. And then we have one group of people. Next, second group is small people, Michunku. They are without power, you know. Anyway, you know, they actually doesn't agree with the power, coercive power exercised by the big people. So they contest the power. And these are our poor, humble, what we call Minap, humble farmers, common people. And the I think one important thing here is when you understand big and small people, it should not be clear dichotomy. No, there's no clear dichotomy. Big people are not, they are not necessarily king or ruler, you know, but they have a range of socioeconomic, religious and economic groups who are above small people, like for example husband and wife. So wife is a small people, husband is a big people. So they should be understood in that way. Because when it comes to relations, you know, the social relations, gets enacted in that dichotomy. So what are the element of dissent? How do you know that there are elements of dissent in the folk tales? Like, I think we have to first, important thing here is we have to study the themes, because the themes validates the big small people's idea of the world, because and then they you have to study the types of character in the folk tales and the plot and the endings and the motives. These are some of the characteristics of folk tales which, when you study the folk tales for element of dissent, you have to look at those characteristics. And in those folk tales, the characters from the small people are at the center of the story, you know, and you know, like whether certain folk tales have the element of dissent or not, you can know from the types of character, the main characters. And the small people, the characters coming from the small people, always come as winners there. And the big people characters, like kings, they always come as losers. And the small characters, by enacting their role, they actually validate I won't call it a Buddhist values. I think these are the universal values. So they actually validate, and then they confirm that these are the values to be observed by the big people, because big people are big because they are associated with certain values, and they have to embody and practice those values. And if they don't, then that very reason moves the plot. And then they rectify the wrongdoings of the big people, the rulers especially. And their endings or the plot or the themes actually reflect the small people's idea of how world should be. You know, the world is, the society around them is not equal. So they wanted it to be equal. And some of the tales goes to the extent of overturning, you know, so nothing short of a revolution, overturning the social status quo, and then the poor farmer's son becomes a king, and the king becomes sort of a servant. So these are some of the things the common people have in mind when they actually compose the folk tales. And the whole, the premise I said, you know, explained in the beginning is that common people are the authors of the some of the folk tales. And when you you have to come place this these stories in the proper historical and social context. Now we have no information on how Bhutan looked like, what Bhutan looked like before 1616. So let's forget that. But the theocracy starting from 1661 to 1907, I think have those times have been very difficult for the farmers. And if you listen to some of the local narratives in the villages, you will hear so many stories about the taxation, the labor, the military conscript. You know, actually, the how and anyway, it, the time has not been peaceful because of these reasons. And then, and my argument here is that these are the very reasons why people were forced to compose folk tales as sort of a satire to actually ridicule, lampoon, or you know, make a jest out of the system, and then you know, and they have their own, which I'll come to later, on purpose. And social structure, just to make a brief point, is a monastic community led. You know, the whole state bureaucracy was dominated by the Buddhism, and the Buddhist monks, the Buddhist clergy, had a monopoly of over art, the government, and culture. And they forcefully, some you know, one way or other, they always determine the common people's values, the culture, their beliefs, and then and the these non-Buddhist so-called non-Buddhist values, which don't have their root in Buddhist Buddhist values, such as oral culture, rituals, beliefs, proverbs, were virtually not heard. You know, they were actually suppressed. Oh, sorry, I think that's a nice word. It has been suppressed. And then the people did not agree with the social order just because it was dominated by the big people. And then they make a fun out of the system. They, as I said, explained in the beginning, they satirize the system, lampoon. And then in some of the days, they revenge, because they, so much of injustice had been done by the system. And so what did they do is, through the plot of the stories and how the stories end, they somehow in the end they take revenge, and their descent, their composition, the way they compose folk tales is how they romanticize. They in their fantasy, they try to escape the harsh realities of the social environment, and then paint a clear picture of the ideal world, you know, and then. The folk tale museum actually provided them with a medium to escape, you know, to escape from the repression and the exploitation of the society at the village level, you know, at the national level, the district level. You know. So there are the different levels in which the big people exercise their power over the small people. And then what the poor people did was they tried to resist those exploitation, the system, physically. I'll narrate one story towards the end. And then as a second alternative, they composed these folk tales. And out of many functions, what function did the composition and the narration of these the folk tales contain a descending voice have is because the very composition narration by the descending generation to the ascending generation of the small people, you know, through this process, I think this brought about changes in the children as well as adults, because these are, and they
the plot was devised in such a way that you know children were made to keep away from those values which were not actually associated with the big people. For example, big people, if you take, for example, a village lama, you know, he should be compassionate, you know, he should be helpful, he should be doing helping people fulfill the spiritual need. But then if the lama engaged himself in business, you know, if they were not compassionate towards their fellow citizen, and then these are the sort of characters they satirized, you know, they wanted to criticize. And then in the story, by listening to these stories, the children were kept, you know, out of those values. They were warned that practice those values, and put those values, then it's not going to work. And then the big people were listening to these tales coming from the common people, you know. I think it definitely had some impact, because if they don't, these are some of the consequences they are going to face. And then I will narrate, not explain one story I compiled from, I think this is from my village. It's about a lazy boy and a king. Once they lived I think he was very, very lazy. Like he refused to cook. He had to be woken up by his mother to eat his food, and then he never went to toilet, he said. And he was too lazy even to wash his face. And then he suddenly was sent to the palace, thinking that he could be, you know, accordingly disciplined. And in the palace, he became so popular, and he becomes a sherpin, like someone who serves food to a king. But in the very day, he is supposed to serve the food to the king. But king here is not the monarchy. I think we should make it clear. I think basically it's this concerns that at the time 250 years of theocracy. Because the Wangchu dynasty, the 1907, is the beginning of the beginning of the peaceful moment in the history of Bhutan, and then the whole taxation, social reform, you know, they brought a lot of changes to relieve the farmer's suffering, especially the physical suffering. So he fasts on the very day he is supposed to offer food to his king, and what the king did was he imprisoned this poor fellow. And then the war of wits starts, you know. And then what happens was, in a series of war of wits, the lazy boy always wins over the king, you know. And then the king felt so embarrassed. So what he did was, he was sent to exile. He banishes the poor lazy boy, the king, out of his kingdom. And on his journey, the lazy boy happens to acquire the golden cup, the hammer, the kobji, sort of a farm implement used to harvest the crop, and then goat skin which could make weather, the golden cup which could give him whatever food he wishes, and the hammer which could fight any enemies. And then with all these four things, he returns home, he goes towards the king, and then they fight, and then through these three magical objects, he wins over the king, and the lazy boy becomes a king. Now, this is a long story, but I made it in short. And now, these are some of the interpretation. The lazy boy is, I think, a farmer's, by portraying one of their son as a lazy, they have also other purpose. They wanted their children to be not lazy, very active, you know, because a farming society cannot afford the lazy labor, you know, because men need to fulfill the twin tasks of lahar, the load carrying and the work, the farm work. And he was made deliberately lazy because whoever might be the composer, he wanted to contrast it with the palace life, you know, because they wanted to contrast how poor, you know, the low quality of the courtiers in the palace. Because the lazy boy could rise up, you know, and suddenly become a court, a sherpin. So he had a very fast career rise. And then why did the poor boy fart? Because I think he wanted to question the necessity of food serving, you know, food service. can a king take food himself? Do he really need to be served a food, a simple as food? And then the science of, you know, farting, what is wrong with farting? The science of gastronomy and the palace norm, you know, there's mismatch. Because you eat food and then if you have some digestion problem, then you, it's natural to fart. But then you have a palace norm, you know, like forbidding someone from farting, something like that, you know. And then the, what the king resort to a universal punishment, like it's everywhere, you know. Once you do some wrong things, then what you do is that the predictable punishment is the imprisonment. No, then the story contrasts the foolish courtiers and the clever lazy boy. And the courtiers, by conventional norm or conventional understanding, they are supposed to be very clever. But here, the lazy boy, he outsmarts all of them. And then the clever boy tells the guard that it's very foolish on the part to imprison a very clever serpent and then be surrounded himself by foolish courtiers. And the king thinks that, and then king calls this lazy boy, and what can you show how clever you are? And the lazy boy just informs the king that, you know, if you can find a person who has never farted in their life, I can make a lot of muti, a sort of a blue pearls, you know, precious items, precious stone. And then for the economic greed, you know, the king suddenly sends his courtiers in four direction to find one subject who has never farted in his life. And the palace the courtiers goes everywhere, and then they finally return, and they could not find anyone who has never farted in their entire life. So then the lazy boy tells the king, that means the king must be the only one. So, you know, you be my friend and then let's make a muti. And the king becomes so afraid. He was so afraid that, you know, that his stupidity could be exposed in front of everybody. So he releases the, Then the king acknowledges that, of course, I also fart. It's a natural process, so I must acknowledge. So the lazy boy is released. And then the, because king felt so embarrassed, embittered, and he really wanted to take revenge, and then he starts with the war of wits. So he assigns the poor boy so many impossible tasks, you know. But then the lazy boy had a proper answer, and then in the process he becomes the king. I think he faces embarrassment after embarrassment. And then here in the story, the story tells the listener is that it's too pity on the king to humble himself to the level of a lazy boy. Like he should be left like that, you know. Like he's not, I think he really wanted to challenge, I think he should be other person, not this poor lazy boy. So anyway, the lazy boy always win. And then finally the king misuses the course of state power, and then he exiles this king, the lazy boy. And as a consequence, he ends up losing his throne, and then the poor lazy boy wins. And then and all this discussion, what I'm trying to say is like this discussion about this descent actually is quite similar to the subaltern literature, which is quite vibrant in South Asia, because in South Asia, until now, in dream colonialism, the whole history has been written from the prism of the aristocrat, the colonial power, rich, you know, the elites, and whereas the peasants, millions of poor peasants have been ignored. So the subaltern study, they try to actually bring poor people, peasants, contribution to the making of history to the forefront. And here, some of the selected folk tales actually provide a clue to how the social relations, the social system had been very unequal and exploitative, you know, especially in the rural areas. And then these stories throws a lot of light on how the dominant and controlled state power and the authority, which were actually the system made by the big people. And then the farmers' resistance to this, this small people's resistance to this use of power, state power. And it is, as I said in the beginning, is the expression of the alternative social order, And social order, not really about the domination. They want the farmers don't want the domination, but they wanted to make it less unjust, less unequal, and less exploitative. And this study of these folk tales actually will help us in understanding the interface between, as explained before, the tension, the interface between the big people and these people. And now the national narratives, in the national narratives, you will see the opinions, the viewpoint, the actors, or perspective, the content of the state, king, lords, the ascending generation, teacher, man or husband. Whereas the voices of the citizen, the subject, the servant, the descending generation, the people, women or wife, you know, have been neglected. And what I'm trying to, one of my main point here is that by studying those selected folktales containing the element of dissent, discontent, and rebellion, we can actually write local narratives, you know, parallel to the national narratives containing the voices, the perspectives of the group of people in the blue color, the state voices. No, we have, you know, in our history, it's all about the history. It, of course, it's being written by people who are in power. So the state, you see a lot of the voice of the state, but then of the citizen, you don't find. Then of the king, but not of the subject. Of the lords, you know, so many in Bhutan we had a lot of religious nobilities, but then their servants, their zapa or those drapa, they were not actually heard. And then of course the if you had the local narratives, sort of a local narratives, it is written from the perspective of the ascending generation, our farmer, you know, and of the voices of the children were not actually heard. And then of the people, always from the teacher's perspective, we have a Namthal, a biography of big lamas, but then we don't have of the disciples. Disciples, when they were disciples, of course, as they grow, they also become a lama, but then what about their lives when they were disciples? And then men, women has been always neglected. Then husband, even at the macro level, then if you can narrow the zoom down, you have now the elder brother, the younger brother. And these are the summary of my presentation. Folk tales reflect social, economic, and political milieu of a particular time and place. And if that is so, it follows, I think, that folk tales originated from some people. This is a big claim I make, and I think, as I said in the beginning, this is a big claim I make. And if you ask me after 2 years, I think I'll have the empirical evidence ready. And there are a lot of elements of dissent and discontent of the small people, our social order made and dominated by big people. This is also, some may say it's a big claim. Well, if you all you need to do is to pick up one of the Buddhist folktales available in English translation, and then if you read those folktales along the hypothesis or the premise I presented, you won't, I think most of the audience won't disagree. And the final point, folktales can be used as a material for writing narratives of small people. So this is my brief presentation. So I welcome.
Very good afternoon, Madam Chair, scholars, dignitaries, teachers, students, and everyone gathered here. Well, it indeed is very inspiring to see so many people gathered here, because it clearly reflects the support and the interest that you show towards this seminar, which has as a theme recognizing and reviving oral traditions. So this is very inspiring. And now, to really go into what I am supposed to do, I would like to begin by recounting a bit about my childhood days. I come from a village, and every winter vacation with my grandparents, I used to go to the pasture land, and I used to listen them tell interesting stories. And it was through their stories that they told me that I could really get a lot of values and many interesting things about the society in which I was born. So, but now, what is actually happening is that we see that this tradition of folktale narration is steadily fading, and it is very appropriate that CBS has come up with this seminar. Even in the school curriculum, as a teacher, I remember teaching Alice in Wonderland and not Bunny's Folk Tales. And as a curriculum officer, I saw and read many, many stories of other countries and very few of Bunny's Folk Tales and Bunny's personal stories. But now, very interestingly, with the curriculum reform, it is heartening to know that the curriculum is now incorporating folktales of Bhutan as well as personal stories written by Buddhist authors. Coming to the media, we storytelling sessions are almost absent, and it would need a lot of effort from all these stakeholders like Ministry of Education, media, research centers, and all the Buddhists to bring back and to revive the storytelling session, which is a very, very important ingredient of Buddhist life. Now, the plan of my presentation, first of all, the title of my paper is Ritualizing Story, A Way to Heal Malady. And the plan of my presentation is, first of all, I would briefly talk about the roles of folktales. And then I would introduce the ritual and the content of the ritual, read the story, and briefly give a comparative look at the ritual and storytelling, and then conclude and give a concluding remark. Now, first of all, when you talk about the rituals, not rituals, storytelling, the most of us. When you talk about the role of storytelling, we directly relate to entertainment, transmission of knowledge, bridging the generation gap. So these are some of the common things that come to our mind. But this paper of mine would like to go a step ahead and then tell that storytelling is more than entertainment and transmission of knowledge and values, but it is also used as a healing process in the villages. And I would demonstrate that and illustrate that through a ritual that I had observed. Now, first of all, let me briefly talk about the rules of storytelling that have been briefly touched upon by the two scholars in the morning. First of all, it is entertainment. As a boy, I'm sure many of us here had the same experiences. For us in the villages, the first purpose of listening to stories was entertainment. Tucked away in the remote villages and devoid of modern entertainment gadgets, one of the entertainments in the villages was storytelling. And even today, if you go to the faraway villages, we still have people telling stories and entertaining their children. So this is one of the reasons. And next one is transmission of knowledge. Coming to the transmission of knowledge, through the stories we learn, we get a lot of knowledge. For example, through the stories, without having gone to Tibet, we know that in the north we have Tibet and in south we have India. Without having seen an ocean, many Buddhists would describe ocean as a large expanse or large body of water, tamijamso, that endless or boundless water. So all these kind of knowledges we get through storytelling. And bridging the generation gap is another important role of folktale or storytelling. Because now with globalization and development, we see that the younger generation they actually do not know many of the things that our parents knew. So slowly, our society actually is cracking down. But a process which can help cement back this gap or bridge the gap between the older and the younger generation is story. For example, when you talk about sacerdotum, that is our fine or mannerism or the fine ways of presenting oneself, and these kind of knowledges we get through folktale or storytelling. For example, we have a story called The Lame Boy, the Poor Boy and the Lame Monkey. And in this story, it is a lame boy who actually teaches this poor boy how to present himself in a very grand and eloquent manner, how to behave in a very dignified manner. So through this story, what we actually know is that in the Buddhist society, we have fine ways of carrying oneself, and it is through the stories that we do. And it's just one example. And of course, there are many similar themes that talk about the Buddhist values. And these values, actually through the storytelling, can bridge and bridge the gap between the older and the younger generation. Another important role is building the community and giving identity to the community. For example, through storytelling, in a particular community, in the morning, the two scholars had also touched on that, the way that the story is interpreted by a particular society itself, by itself, is a way of relating themselves or creating an identity for themselves. Now, in the village where I conducted this research, I have seen that they worship a local deity called Radhab. And there is a story that talks about how Radhab, or this local deity, had come to Bhutan and how this local deity becomes or is worshipped or is elevated to that level from a monk. And his journey to the village called Khodaka in Oniforan region, the story is very interesting. And through the story, when Radhab is coming to Khodaka, the man who actually invited him to that village, on the way, lots of conversation and talk happens between the two. And today, the passes along the route taken by this deity and his friend actually are associated to that particular village, because all the mountain passes are related to incidents related to the conversation that took between them. For example, they reach a particular village, and this monk, who later becomes a deity, says that, "I'm feeling sick." And then the man who accompanied him said, "Well, if you are feeling sick, we don't have a name for this place, and we are going to name it Narimu." That means the sick or the ill mountain. And they cross it further, and a little later, this monk again says, "I'm feeling very lethargic." And then this his friend said, "Well, then let us name this Thilela." Thil means to not to feel lazy or to feel lethargic. So even today, this mountain is referred to as Thilela. And then the deity, this monk, "Have you reached the place that you had offered me?" And then this man said, "Yes, we have reached here, and this is the place." And then the deity said, "Well, this is a very small mountain peak. Actually, you should say that you are going to offer me a very big mountain." And then this his friend said, "Well, I just told you a lie." And then after that, the mountain came to be called a Shobla. And this is how things actually happen. And even today, the village associate themselves with this kind of stories, and it has become an identity for them. And the way of offering, the Radhab, by that society, they make offerings of prayer flag, and the prayer flag that they offer is a white, a small band of white cloth, and it is without any inscription. And of course, there might be other societies where they make the same offering, but this society, the offering of white prayer flag without any inscription, is another form of creating, of identifying themselves and having a collective identity for that particular community. So these are some of the examples of how storytelling and folk tales have become a strong vehicle of building the community and the strength of the society. So And of all, the theme of my paper is storytelling as a ritual to heal malady. And about the healing of malady or illness, there are two ways. One is as a ritual, and one is a real storytelling. This now, I think, is has really gone out of the Buddhist culture. I have not seen that, but as a child, I remember seeing once, observing this once. And this is, when someone is sick, a very a man with a very powerful voice would come and sit near the sick person, and he would have a small table, you call chente, small table, in front of him, and an incense stick would be lighted in front of him, and this man would put his cross leg, he would put his left leg over the right, and sit in a very commanding position. And the theme of the story that he tells is the victory of good over evil, or subjugation of evil or malignant spirits. So through the storytelling, in a very commanding and a very powerful way, ultimately what is expected is the sick person is cured or healed. So this is one way. But the one that I'm going to talk about is a real ritual. A story has been put in the form of a ritual, and this ritual is performed to expel a category of malignant spirit called death. And after expelling this malignant category of evil malignant spirit, what actually is expected is that there's prosperity, happiness in the community or in the household. Now, now I'll go on to talk about the ritual. The name of the ritual is called Gelpo Chuni. Gelpo is a category of malignant spirit, and Chuni is expulsion, or expulsion of the malignant spirit called Gelpo. And this ritual is conducted in the village where I had observed, that's Jena, Georg in Ongifodong. And from my informants, it seems many villages in Ongifodong region, they conduct this ritual. So having introduced the ritual, now I would like to read the story. I'm not a very good very good in narrating folk tales or stories, so I'll just read it for sake of clarity. The story. A very long time ago, in Linkati, the kingdom of King Gesar of Ling, a tree, Chamashin, I do not know the name of this tree, I couldn't manage to find it. The name of the tree is called Chamashin. A tree called Chamashin gave birth to a strange object that appeared like a field sack. People were shocked and worried that it was ominous and might bring calamity to Linkati. However, to the surprise of his subjects, King Gesar of Ling opened the sack and found a baby boy inside. The king decided to bring him up. He was named Changxin Gepo. Changxin, the name is derived from the name of the tree from where this boy was born. King of Changma tree, as he was born from Changma Xin. As the baby turned into a boy, King Gesar of Ling made him the cowboy of his favorite cow called Patenye Kendruzom. The translation of this is, naughty cow where source of all conflict is accumulated. So this is the name of the favorite cow of King Gesar of Ling. Near the cowshed lived a man who cultivated a big wheat field. As the summer wheat turned lush, the man calculated a bountiful harvest. However, to his utter dismay, despite his efforts to protect his field of thriving wheat from animals, every morning he finds that his wheat is eaten by an animal. That summer, he lost all his wheat to an animal that he could not identify, or he did not know. He suspected the cow of King Gesar of Ling, but there was no evidence, and his wheat was incomparable to that of Changxin Gepo, the cowboy. Another season came for cultivating wheat, and the man, like others in the village, did his part. Again, wheat turned green, and despite his effort to protect his wheat field, one morning he found that a small patch of his wheat field was eaten by an animal. He tried to trace the footprints, but could not find one. He kept close guard of the cow of Changxing Gelpo, but to no avail. Who could have eaten the lush wheat? It, of course, was Patenye Kendruzong, the cow of Changxing Gelpo. The cow unlashed itself and went to the wheat field when the man on guard could not help but fall asleep. Just for a while, around the time the first roosters began to give signal of the arrival of dawn, the cow ate its field and returned to its shed. It was a clever cow, for it left no footprints. It wiped the prints of its foreleg with its hind leg, and that of the hind leg with its tail. The man could tolerate no more, so he kept a trap of poisoned arrow. As usual, the cow came to graze in the wheat field, and it was hit by the poisoned arrow. The cow died in the field. The culprit is caught, and the neighbor demands for compensation. However, Changxing Gelpo demands that the skin of the cow be removed and a small chunk of meat be offered to the guardian deities. The man agreed, and after removing the hide, Changxing Gelpo cuts a small chunk of meat and threw it as offering. Two crows came by, but instead of eating the chunk of meat, they fight. Two dogs came by, and they also fought. Two boys came by, and they fought. The mothers of the two boys joined the fight, the husbands, the local leaders, and ultimately, everyone joined in the fight. Finally, the news of the unrest and the conflict that was happening in his kingdom reached the ears of King Geser of Ling. The wise king consulted the best astrologer to diagnose the cause of the conflict and the associated prescription. The cause of all the conflict was Changxing Gelpo, who intentionally did not look after the cow. The recommendation was to chase away Changxing Gelpo beyond the frontiers of Lingkati, kingdom of King Geser of Ling, if peace was to be restored. Thus, a ritual was performed as advised by the astrologer, and Changxing Gelpo was chased away, crossing many rivers and lakes. All the misfortunes and causes of conflict and sickness of Lingkati were also sent with him. Peace and happiness was once again restored in the kingdom of King Geser of Ling. So this is the story of Changxing Gelpo. And now, what is actually interesting to note is, this is the story, and when you look at the content of the ritual, is that it is exactly the same. Gelpo Chuni, the expulsion of the gap or the malignant spirit, the content of this ritual and this story is exactly the same. The only difference is that this is a narrative form, whereas in the ritual, it is explained in a very, very poetic form. So now let me briefly talk about the ritual. In this ritual, what actually happened, it is a very simple ritual, which does not require much preparation. We just need Dunagu, 9 types of cereal, and small quantity, and they cut this changmashi, the small branches of changmashi, and one part, and they make a bundle of changmashi, and one part of it is painted into black, which represents the malignant spirit, and the other part is kept white, representing the ultimate consequence of performing this ritual, that is happiness and goodness. Now, an effigy of Changxing Gelpo is prepared, and a butter lamp is lit, and then a po or a medium performs this ritual, and during the course of the ritual, King Geser of Ling is invited and invoked. After invocation, the Changxing Gelpo is slowly chased away, and before chasing away Changxing Gelpo, the po or the medium narrates this story in a poetic form, and slowly and steadily Changxing Gelpo is scheduled to leave the house, starting right from the rooftop. Rooftop is identified as the residence of the flag deity and the attic to store the straw for the cattle in winter, and then the corner of the house is identified as a place for the mother, and the center of the house as playground of children. So slowly, this malignant spirit death is chased away. So after chasing away this malignant spirit or gap, people have the feeling that they would bring prosperity and happiness back in the community. So this is a ritual, and we also have, this is not the only one, of course I have not done a very detailed study, but from what I understand is that there is a ritual called Karfu, and in that one also, when you study the content of this ritual, Karfu of Tamang village, you come to understand that here there is the same thing happening. The content of the ritual actually is a story where people actually invite God to come down, and a bat goes to heaven to invite the God down on earth. And similarly, Thabe ritual in Ondupadang region. Here we have 13 invocations of the God. And in this 13 invocation, what we actually notice is that this